Michael Jeffries of the State of Nevada, 68338. Mr. Savarese, if you're ready to begin, please do so. If you're ready to begin, please do so.
Honors, may it please the court. My name is Savarese. I represent Mr. Jeffries, who is the defendant appellant in this matter. And it is our contention was denied a fair trial, resulting in his conviction for second degree murder in this case. We have raised four issues on appeal. The first issue is a very profoundly troubling issue of juror misconduct and the manner in which it was handled. We know where misconduct occurred. It is undisputed. Objective evidence in the form of notes from the very conscientious jury foreman, for whom we are very grateful, demonstrate that a juror conducted legal research as to sentencing ranges applicable to the various gradations of homicide that were before the court, which was murder in the first degree, murder in the second degree, and voluntary manslaughter.
Mr. Severese, maybe, I know you're aware we have a recent case law on this. We have Gonzalez case and Bowman and all. Would you like to comment on if you feel those cases are applicable here and
yes.
Why?
Yes, Your Honor. Valdez as well.
Okay.
I would particularly rely upon Valdez and Bowman when it comes to this particular issue. As this court en banc made abundantly clear in Valdez, when a jurors are considering simultaneously penalty while they are deliberating guilt or innocence or gradations of an offense, there is what this court characterized as a constitutionally intolerable risk that this will result in a penalty-based verdict rather than the evidence-based verdict to which an accused is entitled. And that's precisely what we believe occurred, of course, in this case. And the test is one of reasonable probability of actual prejudice having occurred. And I would like, if you will allow me, to outline very briefly a series of circumstances which we submit demonstrate that there is a reasonable probability in this particular case that this circumstance prejudiced Mr. Jeffries with respect to his right to a fair trial as to the lesser offense of voluntary manslaughter.
Before you do that, I have a question about standard of review on this point. The note was read to counsel, as I understand the record, and counsel suggested without objection that the jury be told that they should not be considering penalty and rather should focus on the instructions as given. I mean, there was an actual instruction, and as I read it, defense counsel requested that instruction of the juror and did not move for a mistrial at the time, rather went through to verdict, and then there was a new trial post-judgment.
Correct.
Am I right on that?
Yes, you are.
What does that do to our standard of review in reviewing the argument you're poised to make about prejudice and error?
Well, the standard of review is one of abuse of discretion. It is our position that the risk of the denial of a fair trial in this very fundamental structural manner created an obligation on the part of the district court to sua sponte conduct voir dire of the grand jury to determine whether actual prejudice had attached. Whether or not counsel requested that, we do not believe that is an undertaking that can be committed, can be relegated to counsel's strategic risk. It is that fundamental. And we believe, therefore, that the trial court should have inquired of the jurors as to the extent of the discussion and whether or not this matter of of penalty and the corresponding ranges was discussed, and to what extent it prejudiced or had become an influential factor to each and every member of the jury. We know that the offending juror, discussed this openly with the other members of the panel.
Right, so it went all the way through the jury pool.
That's right. And even though in this court's decision in Bowman, we know from Bowman that one is enough. One is enough. And we certainly had that one. And so long as that juror returns to deliberations, having been influenced by the penalty research that they did, and we know that occurred here because the notes textually reflect that he or she stated, I am against the penalty. And so that juror was clearly influenced. And as the court discussed in Bowman, the risk cannot be taken that this was not discussed and with other jurors. But even if it were not, we know that we were deprived of a jury of 12. And with respect to...
Before you get into the argument, I don't want to take too much of your time, but you made a statement as to arguing involuntary manslaughter. And it seemed from the record, at least my reading, the argument was as to self-defense, not involuntary. If I'm incorrect, please correct me and then make your argument.
Well, the summation of the defense did not argue the lesser included offense of manslaughter, and I acknowledge that. However, that offense was before the jury and they were instructed on it. Now, that was fairly presented to the jury and it was within their province to return a verdict, if not of acquittal on the basis of self-defense, at least for the lesser offense of voluntary manslaughter.
What should the court have done? I mean, you're making a Gonzalez argument with respect to not the note with penalty, but the note about asking about malice and what it means. And
yes.
What instruction do you contend under Gonzalez the district court should have given in response to the malice note?
Well, taking guidance directly from Gonzalez, the answer I would give is an supplemental instruction adequate to cure the jury's doubt or lack of understanding.
But what would that have been?
Well, I'm not sure right now what I would propose, but the trial court could certainly call for instructions to be proposed by counsel for both sides and consider. You know, the court cannot...
There wasn't an error in the way the jury was instructed on malice, right?
That's... I agree. And, however, I don't think that that's necessarily dispositive, certainly, because in Gonzalez, the court said that the requirement of supplemental instruction, when the jury categorically indicates reasonably can be inferred that they lack understanding or are confused, which are two different concepts. And we certainly, I believe, have that here, that the court must provide supplemental instruction, even if the initial instructions were both correct and adequate. And the aspiration, of course, is not that we have a jury that ought to have understood their instructions of law, but that we have a jury who in fact did. And that is certainly the underpinning of the jurisprudence of Gonzalez as far as we are concerned.
But we don't know what you contend the court should have told that jury, that confused jury.
I suppose I could fashion a supplemental instruction if called upon to do so. I don't believe, most respectfully, that that is an essential factor in determining whether, nonetheless, error occurred on this basis.
And you're kind of twinning them. You're saying because you also had the interjection of penalty consideration, it was...
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes, we were saying that the district court had an obligation of heightened scrutiny in this case, knowing as he did that there was extraneous information about sentencing being discussed.
What was the order of the questions coming out from the jury?
The first question that came out from the jury was, I believe, as to the juror having done sentencing research. The note said, you know, one of the jurors went out and researched sentencing, openly discussed it with the rest of the panel. What do we do now? And the second note was, we lack clarity and understanding as to the concept of malice aforethought. And we also lack understanding as to the distinction between second-degree murder and voluntary manslaughter. Those couldn't have been more essential to the legal issues before the jury, as the court states in Valdez.
Did the second and third notes, the ones on malice and second-degree versus manslaughter, did those come out together as a pair, or were they separated by time also?
My memory is that those two came out at the same time. And they were on two different notes, but they were simultaneously referred to the court. The first note regarding reporting the legal research done by the juror was separate, and it was first.
Okay, thank you. That helps.
Now, with respect to whether or not we have a case here where there is a reasonable probability that there was prejudice, I would refer to the court to the following circumstances. We know that the jury was torn between second degree and voluntary manslaughter. The note says so. It is not reasonably probable that the jury was considering first degree murder. And the fact, it's not logical, we submit, that the jury would be expressing their concern between the two lesser offenses if they hadn't already taken premeditation and deliberation off the table. And that was also the perception of the trial court, and he articulated that expressly. He believed that the jury was not considering first degree, and it was going to be between second degree and not guilty. He didn't believe they would find him not guilty, but he completely pretermitted the issue of voluntary manslaughter. And we know that that's where the jury was torn. We know from the note textually that the jury lacked understanding between these two offenses. We know textually from the note that the offending juror was against the penalty, therefore was influenced by the research. We don't know which offense the penalty referred to applied to. However, the note shows that the juror continued to participate in deliberations, and we know that a unanimous verdict of the higher offense of second-degree murder was returned, and perforce, that juror was a member of that unanimous decision.
You're at the two-minute mark. Do you wish to retain some time?
Yes, I would. Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Vinu Palal. I represent the respondent in this matter. On October 23rd, 2011, it's undisputed that Michael Jeffries shot and killed Eric Gore. 3.5 years later, Mr. Jeffries was given a full and fair trial. And the respondent submits that that decision made by that jury, the representatives of the community, ought not be overturned because nothing deprived Mr. Jeffries of a fair trial. Now, I'm going to first talk about, if the court wants me to, I'll first talk about the note from the juror regarding penalty, and then I'll move on to the questioning regarding second degree or manslaughter. And that's the order for the court. That's the order in which it came. Almost immediately upon the jury receiving the case, they were excused that evening, as the record indicates, is about 4:40. The jury was excused around 5. The next morning, almost immediately, there's a court notes that they received a note from the jury foreman talking about the penalty. But it's important, as Justice Pickering noted, that The defense counsel was, is part of this discussion, and defense counsel actually was the one that came up with this way to deal with this note. It wasn't the state proffering it. It was the defense counsel. The state did not object, but it was defense counsel. So, absent clear error, and that's the standard that the state believes should be here, absent clear error, the trial court's decision should stand. And when we talk about...
That the fact situation distinguishes the case from Gonzalez and Bowman and all?
Yes, I think, because in Bowman, you had the defense counsel becoming aware of it aware of the misconduct immediately afterwards,
right.
And then immediately raising the objection or raising the motion for mistrial, mm-hmm. contemporaneous to their understanding of it. The two issues that need to be presented by the appellate are juror misconduct and that the misconduct was prejudicial. And here, there's no showing that the conduct was, in fact, prejudicial. We talk about Bowman. In Bowman, the affidavits presented to the court and their subsequent testimonies demonstrated that their experiments affected their decision-making. Here, we are absent any record of that. In Valdez, appellate counsel mentions Valdez, but in Valdez, it was imminently obvious that they were discussing penalty as part of their guilt phase discussion, because when they render their guilt phase verdict, they also render the penalty verdict. And that was part and parcel of their discussion. Here, the record is completely absent of any notion that penalty was discussed. In fact, the note says, notice it's not that they told us, this person told us about the penalty or that we discussed the penalty. Instead, it said one juror openly stated they looked into the consequence of the plea and they are against the penalty. That's it. That's the full sum of the discussion. And absent more, the appellate cannot show that the defendant was prejudiced in this matter. And in fact,
Counsel for Mr. Jeffries indicates that it was the court's obligation to make a record as to whether or not there was prejudice. What is your response?
The respondent respectfully disagrees. In the appellate refers to Garner and coming with a sua sponte obligation. And what this court said in Garner is where errors are patently prejudicial and inflame the extreme passions of the jurors against the accused, the general rule of the having to object does not apply. That's not the case here. There's no indication that that's the case here. And as such, the court had no sua sponte obligation to jump in and tell defense counsel how to run his case, because that's essentially what the appellant is asking. Now, the other thing is the sequence of the notes is very important to establish the lack of prejudice. So you have at approximately 10 o'clock, the juror issuing this note. Then, at 2 hours later, you have the notes regarding the distinction between voluntary manslaughter and second-degree murder. What is malice aforethought? Well, what inference can we draw from the sequence of notes? That the jurors are struggling with the legal elements of the crimes, and they're trying to apply the facts adduced at trial to those legal elements. These notes indicate that punishment is not the question of the day to the juror. They're doing precisely what we ask a jury to do. Struggle with the law, struggle with the facts, and then come to a conclusion. And I think the question of what should the court have done, what instruction the court should have given, is absolutely dispositive. And the lack of ability to come up with an answer to that is dispositive. Because in Gonzalez, when we're talking about, well, you have to know that your actions are contributing to a conspiracy in order to be found guilty of a conspiracy. The answer is obviously no. And a lot of the logic of Gonzalez is borrowed from Southwell, the Ninth Circuit case that's cited in Gonzalez. And the Ninth Circuit in that case says, before you can determine whether or not the court has erred in not buttressing or adding to the jury instructions, you have to come up with what the answer would have been. And it makes sense. Because if you don't know what, I'm sorry, right?
Okay.
If you don't know what the answer is going to be, how could you put that on the district court, the trial judge, to have come up with an answer when you, even 3 years later or 2 years later, can't come up with the answer?
There's an issue.
Go ahead with your question, I'll follow.
I think what he's saying, though, is that they got the first juror note, and that suggested that there may have been a taint with respect to penalty, and which way that cuts, who knows. But in that context, the second and third notes arrive and suggest that the jurors are struggling with second-degree and manslaughter. And it doesn't take a huge leap to say that the penalty question could have been tied to those distinctions, because each of those crimes carries a different penalty. So I think his point is that given, and maybe if I'm doing a disservice to his point, he'll correct it on rebuttal, but I think his point is that the district court judge should have looked at those together and said, oh my gosh, we gave this earlier instruction, but there seems to be some real debate going on here, and it may be tied to that. And that kind of gave a heightened Gonzalez obligation, if you will. I'm not sure that's his argument, but I think that is. Could you comment on that?
Yes. It's purely speculative, right, to say that a question few hours earlier regarding penalty is now tied to the difference between voluntary and second-degree murder, particularly when the jury questions focus on the right legal issue. The right legal issue here is malice aforethought. So that if it's malice aforethought, it's second degree. If it's no malice aforethought, it's voluntary. The jurors are doing the work that they are prescribed to do. They're struggling with malice aforethought. And so in talking, in going back to Southwell, again, the backbone of Gonzalez, or at least a reference of Gonzalez, the Ninth Circuit said, in order to get to the fact that the district court committed error by not supplementing its instructions, you have to come up with the answer. And in that case, you had the Ninth Circuit's analysis was, here's the answer to the question, and then the court erred in not supplementing with that answer. Also cited by both parties is Harrington, where out of Arizona in 1988, where again, the court found that the appellate court found that the trial court did not give a proper supplementary instruction. But at that time, as in Southwell, as in Gonzalez, defense counsel asked for the answer to be given, and then the trial court denied it. And importantly, in all these decisions, where supplemental instructions were given, the answer was, one, abundantly clear, and two, requested for by defense counsel. Here we have nothing. How would we, in the hypothetical, how would one answer, can you further clarify malice aforethought? Would it even be the proper follow-up instruction? And wouldn't, arguably, a proper follow-up instruction on malice aforethought, which is prescribed by the legislature, be misconduct in and of itself? By supplementing that instruction. Now, if the question would have been, is malice aforethought an element that we need to find in order to find second-degree murder, then, of course, the district court would have, under Gonzalez, would have had to supplement the instruction and say, yes, you have to find malice aforethought in order to find second-degree murder. That's not here.
And you've just posed my question, and after we come back to Gonzalez, you both expressed your opinion as to how Gonzalez works. The question is, in this case, Gonzalez was decided after this case was final, after the judgment came down. Do we apply Gonzalez retroactive to this case?
The state's position would be, no, you do not apply. You would not apply Gonzalez retroactively, but even if you were, again, Gonzalez is not applicable here in the manner in which the...
We get that in terms of you saying it's not applicable, your position. The question is, why shouldn't we apply it, if that's your position?
Because it doesn't implicate a constitutional right that would have retroactive application. The last thing I'd like to address...
Well, Gonzalez, both the state and the defense agreed that the answer to the questions was whatever, no or yes. And yet the district judge refused to give a supplemental instruction. So that's really different from our record.
Exactly. Both, and I think what makes that more notable is that the answer to the question was obvious, right? So obvious that both the defense and state could come with the answer. You have to knowingly participate in a conspiracy in order to be found guilty.
Right.
Here, there's just no obvious answer. It's really up to the jury to struggle with what malice aforethought is. That's their job. That's their province. I know it wasn't addressed by appellate counsel, but would the court like me to address at all the prosecutorial misconduct aspects allegations?
It was raised. Go ahead.
All right. The two issues brought up by Mr. Zdrosky during his rebuttal argument were, one, the fact that Mr. Jeffries had an influence directly, or actually he says indirectly, on Brittany Ames. She was a 13-year-old girl at the time the murder occurs, and she's 16 years old at the trial. And Mr. Zdrosky's argument is fairly based on inferences from the evidence adduced at trial. What Brittany Ames testified was that her mom was still dating the defendant, that her mom would tell her how great the defendant was, and that her mom would tell her how well she's been treating the mom. And in the intervening 3 years, before trial, after the murder, the couple gets engaged. And so you have Brittany Ames, 13 years old, 16 years old at trial, she's sitting there with, if the defendant is acquitted, she's going to be living with him as her stepfather. Of course, that has some influence on her testimony and is proper commentary. The other issue brought up as prosecutorial misconduct by Mr. Zdrosky is the him saying that I really liked this witness. And I think that was not the issue with regarding witness vouching is to put the prestige of the state upon a witness. And here, it's almost to the contrary. Mr. Zdrosky spends all of Brittany Ames' testimony impeaching her with prior statements. He's trying to more, what he's doing there is trying to prevent the jury from turning its ire to Mr. Zdrosky for having just done a very difficult thing, which is impeach a 16-year-old who witnessed the murder as a 13-year-old and had to testify against her future stepdad in open court. And so when Mr. Zdrosky goes on about the not inconsistencies, but her lack of memory at jury trial, he's trying to inoculate himself from not to put the prestige of the state upon the witness. If there are no other questions,
Able to make. Justice Gibbons, anything additional?
No.
And Justice Pickering?
No, thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Savarese, we'll give you a full 3 minutes because I know you'll want to weigh in on the Gonzalez question as well.
Thank you, John.
Mr. Savarese, before maybe start your time, my question is this, and please, you can respond anytime you want in your 3 minutes. You weren't the trial counsel here. I think Mr. Kane, I believe, from the public defender's office did. I'm concerned the fact that he created the remedy here by requesting the supplemental instruction to the jury. It was at the request, as Mr. Palau pointed out, from him to do that. And how does that play into our analysis here? Is there a waiver, or how would you address that?
Well, Your Honor, I appreciate the concern. Ed Kane is a friend and colleague who I've known for a great many years, my dad used to say, there isn't a barber that's shaved so close that another man can't find a little work. And it pains me to have to make this argument. But our two responses to this, on the one hand, is the sua sponte obligation of the district court. There was enough here for the district court to have pause and not to turn a blind eye to this development. Secondly, we believe and have raised in the brief ineffective assistance as a matter of law. Now, we understand that is an argument that is generally reserved for post-conviction proceedings. However, the court's jurisprudence does allow for direct appeal review if it is something where there is no real need for an evidentiary hearing as to counsel's motives. Here, there was no risk in asking for a voir dire of the jury to determine whether prejudice occurs. You know, my brother makes a go out of much of the fact that there's no evidence that the jury discussed this or to what extent it influenced their decision. But we don't know that precisely because there was no inquiry. But we know there was enough to call for one, and we know the importance of not doing so because Valdez says it is an intolerable constitutional risk that a penalty-based verdict will result. Now, Mr. Kane, with all due respect to him, should have asked for the voir dire. He didn't have to move for a mistrial immediately. He could have asked for the voir dire, and then, If that showed actual prejudice and influence, move for the mistrial then. If it did not, he could have proceeded and allowed deliberations to continue confidently and safely that he had an impartial jury and have held out for acquittal and have maintained double jeopardy protection. But he should have inquired. This matter should not have been allowed to be ignored. The risk of constitutional violation in fair trial and impartial jury was simply too great, and this court has recognized that. Now, have I answered your question?
Yes, thank you.
Counsel, that was my first note. With respect to my brother's argument that there's no evidence that there was an effect on the jury, the juror said she was against the penalty. There's no accounting for how that influenced the deliberations parsing between second degree and voluntary manslaughter. The fact that the jury was continuing to struggle with the elements doesn't mean that there wasn't influence, knowing about the comparative penalty ranges, that this juror, and the likelihood is, was against the lesser penalty for voluntary manslaughter, and not against the greater penalty for first-degree murder. That's not the reasonable probability in this case.
Give us your time is up, but give us your closing thought.
Well, my closing thought, Your Honor, let me just address very briefly, 1 second, on the prosecutorial misconduct issue, because it was raised. When Mr. Sadrowski told this jury that my client certainly worked on Brittany Ames for 3 years to influence her testimony, there's nothing in this record that justified that comment. That is an accusation that my client committed a crime to get away with another crime and had consciousness of guilt for the homicide that he was charged with, at the level of murder. So I don't, there's a distinction between a circumstance where he's the mother's fiancé. Sure, you can draw an inference from that. But arguing that he certainly worked on her to influence her testimony was highly inflammatory and had no justification. That's not an inference from the evidence. In fact, the evidence was quite to the contrary.
Was there an objection to that?
There certainly was, yes. And with that, I'll conclude, Your Honor, unless there is another question.
No other questions. Thank you.
Thank
both counsel for arguments this day. This matter will stand submitted at this time. We're in recess.